Welcome to the Inferno Cast. Today's guest is a six-degree black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. He's won multiple championships, and he's well-known throughout the world from his influence on Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu to MMA. Vinicius Magalhães, also known as Draculino. How are you doing today, sir?
Doing good, Caleb. How about you guys? Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, you're welcome. I really appreciate you taking time. I've been a major fan forever, you know, not only just because you're kind of almost in my weight class and your stuff works for me. But, you know, just your influence on the industry and just following you over the years. And you've really been a pioneer for the sport. And I feel like you've been a pioneer for the sport with, like, the right attitude. And I just wanted to say thank you, and I appreciate everything you've done for us. But today I really wanted to talk about some of the beginnings of your jiu-jitsu career, as far as, like, how did you find martial arts as a kid? Was there an influence, you know, movies, books, friends, family? Was there something specific that kind of triggered your interest when you were younger?
Brother, you know what's funny? Like, I started judo when I was like around 5 or 6. It was my first martial arts. And like in Brazil, like almost every kid starts in judo. It's like it's kind of like the norm. You know, it's changing a little bit now, but it was always the norm for decades. But honestly, even before that, Caleb, for some reason, I was always attracted to combat and to, quote me, violence in a way. It's actually funny because a lot of people used to draw, you know, the sun, like little kids do the sun and the house, and some other kids put like their dogs. And I always would put like people kind of like punch each other or with the guns, like the cowboys. Yeah. And then one time my aunt said to me, like, why you always draw this kind of things? Because my name is Vinicius. Vinicius, I'll tell your dad, look at the other draws of the other kid. And I don't know why I did that. So it's something that like always attracted me, like the combat part of things. It always attracted me since I was a little kid, and I do remember that really well. So it's funny that I did judo for some years. I think I trained from like 5 to 6 to 9. I got my yellow belt as a kid. I competed in judo a couple of times when I was a kid. I remember that the two times I got smashed after the second or third match. I remember this clearly still today. Okay. But what took me to jiu-jitsu wasn't actually judo, was surfing, you know, because I moved houses in Rio to be really close to the beach. And my grandfather used to live on a building there. It was like beachfront, literally. From there, veranda, I could see who was on the beach. Actually, it was that bad in big waves. When the sea was like with storms, the waves would crash literally by the door, by the entrance of the building and everything. But anyways, and then I start surfing. Through surfing, and I love surfing still today. I love it, still love it. Through surfing, I got to meet that crew that nowadays, everybody knows them. They don't know that they're surfers, but they know them really well. But the Gracie family with Hanzo Haufenhayen, Roberto Gordo, Elio Soneca, Alexander Soca, Daniel Gracie, and tons of other guys. And then through surfing, I started, you know, because of the Gracie family there, jiu-jitsu fell into my lap pretty much. It was like, man, it was something that was there. I mean, there was so many beach fights, and I was seeing, for example, Hanzo, like super skinny, like, I don't know, 60 something kilos, like getting like huge guys, big, strong surfers, choke them, you know, like, I was like, whoa, man, that's cool. It's I got to give it a try. And then I end up training jiu-jitsu. The first one to teach me formal classes was a guy called Totila Jordan Pitoco. He's a 6-degree black belt nowadays. He was under Romero Jacare from Alliance. I took my first classes with him, and he was also really good friends of everybody surfing. And then when I got hooked to jiu-jitsu, man, it was natural that I would go to the Gracie Academy. That was like across the, like really close to my house and really close to the place that we used to surf. And then here I am still today. But it's funny that not just for me, but a lot of people got drawn into jiu-jitsu through surfing.
You know, so do you think there's a parallel between what it takes to be good at surfing, you know, like finding your balance, finding the wave? Like, is there a parallel between jiu-jitsu training and surfing that you see or connect with?
I don't think so. I know so. Surfing culture It's very also like based on rules, almost like a martial art format. It's based on rules, unwritten rules, but rules, you know. And also, it's very physical. Like, you have to pretty much sometimes deal with near-death experience, you know, a lot of times. Like, I think almost every surfer dealt with near-death experience if they got decent in surfing. It's my case, and it's the case of probably 90% of people that surf, who surf. So I think the connection is not even just physical connection that requires you to be in shape, requires you to overcome sometimes, like, you paddling and you can't go towards the break line, and then you're just getting smashed by waves, and you have to overcome. Sometimes, man, you feel like quitting, but you don't quit. You go, so all of this is related, but I think it's more the rules and the culture. You know, for example, in surfing, if you get in a wave, for example, towards the left, and then if you're like behind and the guy goes in front of you, that's totally unacceptable. And a lot of times when they do that, there will be some kind of conflict for sure, because this is kind of like the ultimate disrespect. As long as you are a local from the place. So you see what I get?
It's the unspoken culture.
Exactly. It's this rules that eventually guides to conflict. So many times beach fight happened with me, myself, and I saw countless. There's like an epic beach fight from Hickson against Hugo Duarte that everybody saw on YouTube. It was actually in front of my house. I used to be right. It was like, I wasn't there, but I could like literally see from the front of my house. It like my apartment, actually. But anyway, so these cultures were really related in regards to that. And man, like, jiu-jitsu was super handful for surfers to handle their business.
Yeah.
So the influx of surfers going to jiu-jitsu was huge. It was way more than the other way around, but it happened too. It happened like the other way around, like people that used to just train jiu-jitsu and get to know surfers and go, you know what I mean? But it was in Brazil easily the two cultures that were like more connected and parallel to each other by far, by any other martial art. This I know for a fact.
What is it that you think attracts people to surfing that is the same thing that attracts them to jiu-jitsu? Like, what does that do for people's life, do you feel like, that fulfills them? You know, like, you know, what makes them, sure, man, they find surfing, they stay with it. They find jiu-jitsu, they stay with it. Like, what is it, do you feel like, what need do you feel that's meeting for people?
It's the lifestyle. Because surfing and jiu-jitsu, they're not only disciplines or sports. When you get to be serious in jiu-jitsu, you dive into that lifestyle. Surfing is the same thing. You know, not necessarily that you're going to be a competitor or a professional. It's like you're always going to take this to your grave. It's part of who you are when you get in a certain point in surfing and jiu-jitsu. I don't surf often because now I live in Texas, even though I live close to the sea.
Yeah.
The waves here are not.
Yeah. Yeah, Texas, there's not surfing waves in Texas. Yeah, we get
5 times per year, there's some decent waves. That's it, when there's a storm or whatever. Anyway, so I think it's a lifestyle, Caleb. It's a lifestyle for both, for surfing and jiu-jitsu, that people take this to the rest of their lives. So it's way more into just the sport itself. It's about everything else. You know, so people relate to that. And also, I think that's the tribing thing. Jiu-jitsu is very tribal. Right. Surfing is as tribal as well. People start to belong to something. And everybody, as us human beings, we're social beings. So you want to belong to surfing. You want to belong to something that you fit in. A lot of times, and people never fit in anything, and then they find jiu-jitsu. Sometimes they got bullied at school, humiliated, they're socially oppressed. Their ideas are kind of like, shut up, or whatever. When they go to jiu-jitsu, man, jiu-jitsu is a big equalizer. Nobody really cares. As long as you're there and doing your best, you're going to be part of the crew. Yeah. And then they go like, man, the toughest guys in town are my friends. You know, I don't care about these losers that are like bullying me and humiliating me. They won't do this anymore. So it's a good kind of confidence that changes people's lives. In surfing, it's kind of the same thing. In surfing, the kind of guy who like, man, like, I love, you know, certain parts of the surfing culture that everybody says like, oh, this is BS or whatever, blah, blah, blah. Man, I love it. And a lot of other people love it too. So you fit in something, you know what I mean? So I think it's a lot to do with that.
What do you think people are really missing in like normal social circles and just in life in general that really draws them into jiu-jitsu? Like, do you feel like there's a kind of, do you feel it's singular? Like there's one thing that kind of draws them in, or is it kind of a multiple? If you were going to kind of paint it with a broad brush, mm-hmm. what do you feel like people are missing that they really need that jiu-jitsu gives them?
Easy. The human touch. Man, everybody tends to go and, oh, don't touch me, especially in America. Oh, don't get close to me. Or you get close to somebody, oh, excuse me. But in reality, people under certain rules and circumstances, they want to be touched in a good way. They don't want to be feared or being touched. Nowadays, people they're scared of being touched. Man, with jiu-jitsu, all we do is to touch each other and grapple each other. So you started to live better. You started to deal better with this thing. Man, some people get into jiu-jitsu, I'm not going to lie to you. Brother, they're not being touched for 10 years. They're not even getting a hug from their dad and mom. They're single, so they don't hurt. They don't touch anybody. Can you believe that? People feel the need of that. And then when they go there, they grapple. Man, they change their life. I heard this from a bunch of people. I heard one time, there was this kid in Brazil. His name is Henrique. And he used to be my student for, man, like years. And when he first joined, literally, he always trained good. He did his thing. But I took 6 months to listen to his voice. I didn't know his voice, Caleb. The kid was like, hey, Enrique, how you doing? How's everything? Everything okay? You coming tomorrow? And then, like, with the time, one time I go to say, hey, Enrique, look, man. We need to have a conversation now. I was just wondering. I have so many students, but I never listened to you. I never heard your voice. Tell me something. Are you deaf or something, or a mute or something, or what? And he goes like, "No, professor. Yeah, because I'm not really a good talker. I'm shy, but I'm getting better through jiu-jitsu." And all I said, "Hey, look, man. You don't need to be shy to talk. You can talk as much as you want here. You know." Don't worry about it. Don't feel bad about it. Nobody will do anything. We're just making fun of you because you don't talk. So you better to talk. And they go, yeah. Oh, so he changed the kid's life. He's married now, you know? And the kid was like, you know, when you see the kid completely quiet and even the body language like this. Yeah. And now he got married, has kids. And I'm pretty sure the jiu-jitsu had a lot to do with that. So this is better than make a champion, in my opinion, for sure. You know what I mean?
It's almost like the personal growth that people get from this experience. You know, exactly. That's the most valuable piece. You know, I was talking to somebody the other day about, you know, world championships and medals, and mm-hmm. and they were like, well, the medals and the championships are just a reflection of the real journey. And, exactly. And I thought that was profound. So then my question is, what do you feel that the real journey is for people?
Man, the real, you said it perfectly, Caleb. Like, getting a medal, getting titles is really cool. I was a high-level competitor for decades. And when I entered there, I was like do or die, and I tried my best, and I would cry if I lost and all that. Because, I mean, I was always a competitive guy. But with the time, like you said, when you get older, you know, one of the good things about getting older, get wiser, and you get more experience. And I started to see that this was actually really clear on my last fight, Caleb. I had in 2010, the last time that I went to something competitive, it was an MMA fight that I did in Strikeforce. It was a big card here in Houston. It was actually, the title fight was Jacare versus Tim Kennedy, actually.
I remember this fight. Yes, yes.
You remember this fight? Yeah.
So, I do.
So here, there you go. So on this fight, man, of course, I was already 40 years old. So, man, I'm actually like that because I have a really bad neck with herniated discs. And I can't be downstairs because of my wife and my kid are working there. So I have to be here upstairs, but I don't have a chair, so I have to put my neck in something. So it's not because I'm lazy, it's because I have no other option. But anyway, my neck was like, almost took me off out of the fight. And other injuries, I train hard because I never go to something, take it lightly. But man, the week of the fight, you know, I had like a Gordo, my MMA coach. Every fight that I did, he was in my corner. And Soka too, Alexander Soka is like one of my best friends. He was here helping me in the last week of the fight. And then, man, like probably three days before the fight, I was doing like kind of like the training to keep the weight down and all that. Man, I sat and I thought about it. It was like, man, you know what? Being here with my brothers, feeling that great again after 40 years old. Man, getting my career to get on this point that I could be still doing this and making a good living. You know what, man? Excuse me my French, but I don't give a fuck if I win or lose, honestly. Of course, I'll go there and die there. But yeah. This moment made me feel so happy. That made me, I swear to God, made me way happier than when I got my hand raised. Thank God I won. But man, this was like, man, that's it. The preparation, being with my brothers, being with something that really wants my best, being ready. This is what counts. The journey, the whole training, my whole life into this. Everything was way more significant than the fight itself. Of course, I would go there, man. Like, I would go there and I still have a little bit of the old school mentality. I never tapped in my whole life, even in jiu-jitsu. I passed out and I broke my arm, but I didn't tap. And I'm not telling people not to do it. Right. Stupid not to tap, but I'm just a stupid guy, old school guy that I did this in the past. So I would go there. Every time I would go there, I was kind of like, man, like I'm ready to die. That's the day that if I die, I'm going to die happy because I'm dying what I'm doing. So I had this mentality when I went there. I won. It was great. I got happy. It was like, man, you know, like after all these years, 5 years now fighting MMA, I won, well, whatever, big event, whatever. But man, that's the difference between how I felt on that other moment and the moment of the fight was totally different, Caleb. Yeah. I was way happier before. I hugged my brothers. I thanked them. I was like, man, I feel great. Being already here with you guys and all this thing I went through is already a victory. That's yes. It. That's how it really felt. And I think this translates to all of us. Everything that we went through, everything that the day by day, the mat talk, the days that you got crushed, the days that you overcame, this is what counts. The other thing is a reward, which is great, but this is not the main thing. I never fought as a main thing after a certain, you know, maturity, I would say that. So I hope like people now will listen to this and they know, they understand that eventually they'll get there.
And that's kind of what I was going to allude to was, you know, I've heard it said that fulfillment is between where you are and where you're going. You know, they're always like, it's usually not at the goal. It's not the victory that's, you know, that's that moment can be fulfilling, but the true fulfillment is usually in between those. And then usually after that, because after you have the moment, what's the first thing you do? You share it with all the people that you care about and you love.
Yeah.
You know, like it's not really that moment is what it was. It's that you now get to share that moment. Exactly. And I feel like that's what you're describing. And that goes to another piece of young athletes, you know, younger martial artists. Sometimes I feel like it's hard for them to discern the difference between being in love with the goal and in love with pursuit of the goal.
Oh, definitely, man. Definitely. I'm glad I didn't talk about that.
What wisdom would you try to give somebody that's more in love with the goal than the pursuit of the goal to kind of get them on track? What do you feel like they need to realign?
Man, like, look, we were all young before, right? I mean, being like the confidence that jiu-jitsu gives you sometimes changes people's life. Sometimes people, they were oppressed or they were not happy or they didn't have any fulfillment. Sometimes it goes like also like how can I say, a collateral. Sometimes these people get too cocky, too like aggressive, too much. I'm the best. I don't give a damn about anybody. whatever, I'm better than you, so that's all it matters and all that. And I get it, you know, some, for you to be a competitor, you have to have that a little bit. You have to have that, like, I'm the better, I'm the best, yeah. And I have to do that. But man, like, what people have to understand is this, you know, I've been there. I was never the best because Hoyler was always blocking me to be the best in the world. But anyway, I was up among the top guys in jiu-jitsu my times, you know, in the 90s. But man, what people don't understand is that this goes out really quickly. You are the best one for several years or for some time, and then eventually you won't be. That happens to every single person in history. You get older, you get injuries. You get somebody that sometimes will show up and it's better than you. It's going to happen. The art evolves. And then if you put all your aces and everything on being the best one that matches everybody, if all your money is in there, man, you're going to have a problem later because we're not the best anymore. What are you going to do? You're just going to be remembered by being cocky, by closing all your doors, by being like a disrespectful to people, and then you're not the best guy in the room anymore. So people, let's say you wanna open a gym or you open a school, you wanna be doing something big. The examples, the kind of people that most likely you attract will be people that would be with the mindset similar to yours, to the person's. And then when they backstab you or they leave you, whatever, there's nothing you can do because they say, look, I'm doing exactly what you did. I'm behaving exactly like you did. How are you going to judge me or talk something about me? You know what I mean? That's what I'm saying. How? And then like when you get older and then one of his students like goes like a loud mouth on the internet, talks all kinds of craziness, and you go say, hey, man, dude, come on, tone down a little bit. I know it's like, you can say whatever you want in a free country, but man, like, it's not good for you, not good for our team. And he goes like, look, what are you talking about? I'm doing the same thing you always did. Yeah. You know, and that can be dangerous. And then I saw already during jiu-jitsu, man, so many great guys, Caleb, great, like absolute champion caliber, like toughest that you can imagine, the man of the hour for years. Man, nowadays, because of the actions of the past, they closed doors a bunch of people, they burned bridges, and they were disrespectful, and they didn't act the way they should act. They're irrelevant now.
Yeah.
They're gone. Nobody talks about them. It's sad, actually. I feel sad because it's the kind of guy who gets in touch with you, like begging to teach a seminar at your place to get paid like almost nothing.
Right.
So is that what you want to be? When you're not the man anymore, I don't think it's intelligent. I don't say people to be a monk, man. I'm not a monk. I have all flaws and I talk crap too and I'm aggressive. And I have like, man, I have a lot of flaws, you know? But I was always in my mind that there's way more into being the toughest guy and the champion in this game. Nowadays, man, I'm more well-known than when I was a great competitor. Way more because I'm leaving, I think I'm doing my best to leave my legacy.
Yeah.
Man, like I have like literally almost a thousand black belts directly under me or under my black belts, literally almost a thousand. And man, 95, and I'm not even joking, 95% of these guys, we're all together still.
Yeah.
Because I think they got the example of sincerity, of honesty, of loyalty, you know, of being true to yourself. You know what I mean? So this is, for me, it's way more than any title, any medal that I got or I could have gotten.
Yeah.
So I wish these people could be like 15 years ahead of time now in their position and then go back in time. And then they go like, man, you know what? I have to change it. I have to be, you know, even we're talking like before he off record, Conor McGregor. Conor McGregor is an amazing fighter, amazing, great technician. Man, I'm a big fan of him as a fighter, for sure. And man, his last fight, I was really happy and surprised on him. Still the tough guy, the aggressive. I go there to kill you. I don't give a damn. But man, like he toned down a lot. He was really respectful. And he got more fans. He got more, well, he made more money.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. He apologized for a lot of things that he did with the Khabib's incident or whatever. He went, he had to deal with like a legal problem and everything. Man, he learned. That was great to see. He learned. He's still the old Conor, tough guy, amazing. You know, go there and then kill or be killed, which we all like it. And he still talks what he thinks. He's real to himself. I like that. Like the Diaz brothers. I love the Diaz brothers. They're true to themselves and they're not like different with camera and off camera. I respect that a lot, you know? But man, like people have to think a little bit more than the moment, not 5 minutes ahead.
Yeah.
Everything changes, man. Everything changes and I have to build a legacy. So eventually people learn. And my advice is just to try to listen to the people that are a little more experienced than them, and hopefully they're gonna learn.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's difficult whenever you're in a combat sport that's highly competitive, you know, where you have to overcome so many physical obstacles and emotional obstacles. It's a fine line of having that warrior spirit of kill or be killed, but yeah. Then at the same time you have this kind of honor code that exists kind of around that.
Yeah.
That I think sometimes it's hard to tap into the difference between intensity and anger, especially exactly. As a young competitor. Because like yeah. A lot of times you have coaches, they're trying to inspire their athletes to be more intense, and
yeah. All
they know how to do to get the intensity is to increase the anger. And so yeah. You know, that athlete doesn't know any different. So then they use anger and frustration and they build up this, you know, kind of circumstance to win this fight. I have to do it. Mm-hmm. I hate this guy or things of that nature because they don't know how to transition over to intensity that yeah. Has nothing to do with anger.
Yeah.
You know, and there was an MMA fight. I remember when Tito Ortiz fought Randy Couture for the first time. I feel like that demonstrated because Tito always got very emotionally loaded
yeah. With
his opponents and he performed well. And Randy just never gave him that energy. And yeah. I feel like it threw Tito off where he struggled yeah. Performing then. And then as he got older, I think that his maturity and he figured it out.
But yeah. In
that moment, I could almost feel it just because I was a younger guy then too, competing and fighting. And I was kind of understanding. I was like, man, it's hard to get mad at Randy Couture. You know, like it was just difficult. And I feel like it took a little bit of his competitive edge off. So if yeah. You were going to try to get an athlete to understand the ultimate level of intensity to where you die on the sword. How do you bring that out of an athlete without it being attached to something unhealthy, like, you know, anger and frustration and just out of control, yeah. You know,
I totally understand what you're saying, Caleb. And look, as being a coach for all these years, there's all kinds of people, right? Man, I know the kind of fighters, for example, that I coached, that I knew, that they are naturally aggressive. They are natural aggressive persons. You don't need to psych them up at all. You need to calm them down. It's the kind of guy that is don't slap on the face before a match like some people do. You actually hug him and do like this and relax, brother. And there are other people that have to psych them up a little bit because they are kind of more like on the, not scared, but they're kind of more like on the defensive zone and all that. So people are different. But one thing that is a rule for myself as a coach that I always try to put on my fighters is like this. Look, as soon as the match or the fight starts, there. Remember that this guy is trying to take your head off because it's true. So if it's within the rules and you have the chance to do so, you do so because otherwise he can do it to you. So don't be naive because it's combat. But at the same time, understand something. I always say that to the guys. Look, after it's over, I want him to give this guy all the respect. And if you want to drink a beer with him and hang out with him, you should, because he's a warrior like you are. And you guys are here for a mutual agreement. You guys want to do this. You guys want to get paid to do this. Or you guys going to get a medal to do this. And then after that, it's gone. You know, you guys are actually the same. You guys are the same. You got to respect each other. You guys are two warriors that agree to do something under certain rules. Don't cheat. Don't do anything that is not under rules. Okay? And then do your best inside in there, and that's it. For you to be like pissed off with the guy or angry with the guy, especially if you're already over aggressive, this is actually one of the worst things that can happen to you. As bad as you actually looking at the guy within the match, man, this guy's so cool. You know what? I'm not gonna give my best. You know what? This is not good either. This is not good either. So it's a middle ground that people have to find. That you said, you gotta be intense and you gotta do whatever it takes within the rules. But anger is a totally different thing. And also, too much empathy is not good too. If you're doing combat sports, if you have a lot of empathy for the guy that is in front of you, that's not good too.
Do you feel that a lot of coaches run into the empathy problem as they continue on? As the coaches, more they coach them as a competitor, do you feel like coaches as a competitor, the empathy becomes more difficult as they get older just because they coach so many students and they help so many people?
Yes, it does. It does. That's why it's very complicated for you to hear like a super high level coach and still a competitor. It's tough. It's a tough job to do because I think that too much empathy can be as bad as too much anger, you know? So yes. So you have to have like a middle ground, you know, understanding people's differences. But I really believe that it's really important that if you are still a competitor, you have to be able to be shut down a little bit your other roles.
Yeah.
That's hard to do. That's very
It's almost like you have to have a degree of selfishness as a competitor. Like you know, because if you feel that sympathy or, you know, like when you're in the round and you're like, are you okay? If that comes out in competition.
It can happen. If it happens to you, you're going to pay eventually. It's like I said, it's as bad as anger.
Yeah.
Maybe even worse.
I would say it's probably worse. So you mentioned about the Warriors have the mutual agreement that during that moment of competition, they follow the rules and, you know, they're trying to kill each other. Would you say that there's almost a level of trust between competitors that's probably deeper than most other people in their life?
100%. I think jiu-jitsu is very, has this very strong bond that connects everybody. So you see that most people had their best friends in the jiu-jitsu gym. This is a fact. And I think it has to do a lot, Caleb, of the fact that you have to trust that person so much that they're not going to kill you, that they're not going to break your arm, that they're not going to break your leg. You are in an agreement like this. Look, you got me, checkmate. I tap your leg off. This is the ultimate level of trust, brother. And then without people knowing, they eventually get so close to each other because, man, I mean, I can trust this guy in my life. And he can trust his life on me too, you know? And I think like in combat, a lot of times, not a lot of times, but most of the, like 90% of the times, when they go, even though they have something against each other, they hate each other, they're like it's something personal, but they know in deep, like, man, that's the honor warrior there that, whenever he knocks me out, the ref will say stop and he will stop. And the same thing with me. So we have this agreement. After the match, you see that like 90% of the people, even if they hate each other, they hug each other after, because that's a recognition of being pretty much the same, of being pretty much in accordance to a warrior honorable code. You know, and this actually happens not just in fights, Caleb, but it happens in every jiu-jitsu gym every single day. Everybody gets choked. Everybody gets armbarred. Everybody gets leg locked in a really tough and dangerous positions that can take you to the hospital. They can kill you. They can, you know, like give you a lot of harm. But they are there happy, safe, because they know that they can trust their brothers and sisters.
Do you think
that's like the biggest bond ever, you know?
Do you think that that correlates to what you said as far as what people are looking for in jiu-jitsu? Like those 100%. Moments of trust where 100%. They are just completely connected to somebody that is taking care of them because they let go when they tap, that kind of connects that, you know, that goes back to what brought them in the gym.
100%. Look, I don't know about you, Kelly. I'm going to ask you this question too. But look, for me and to most people that I know that are into jiu-jitsu like we are, like making our living and all of that, our best friends are from jiu-jitsu. I don't know you, but my best friends, not all of them, but I would say easily, 90% of my best friends, no count family, friends, are I met in jiu-jitsu. I got them because of jiu-jitsu and through jiu-jitsu. How about you?
Absolutely, yeah.
And why you think is that? It's not a coincidence. Why yeah. I don't have my best friends, 90% of my best friends from school or from my law school that I did? Why are not those guys my best friends nowadays and the jiu-jitsu guys are?
Yeah.
Why? That's a reason for I keep thinking about that. And the reason why we talked about before is one, and the trust and being there and the touch, the human touch and all that. But also because we end up being a tribe, end up being with the same lifestyle, the same way to think. Our souls are very cool, are very similar. You know what I mean? Yeah. So that's, I think, the more I try to think about an explanation, that's what gets closer to the explanation about why jiu-jitsu is what it is, and martial arts, I say.
You know? True, you know, because, I mean, there's a lot of different martial arts styles and things that bring people together. Why is it, do you feel, the culture of the realistic combat sports? Like, I would put into that, you know, boxing, yeah. wrestling, jiu-jitsu, yeah, MMA. Yeah. Why do you feel that the relationships and the camaraderie amongst those styles might be different than other more traditional styles? Not, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not saying better or worse, just different.
No. I get it. I understand. No, totally.
Why do you feel that it's different?
So apart from everything we said before about the grappling, the touch, the human touch, I think that has to do a lot also, Caleb, with the Gracie family. Totally. Because the Gracie family, the jiu-jitsu that I practice and you practice, of course, was born in India, and then went to China, and then Japan, and then Jigoro Kano to Count Koma, and then the Gracies, and then other people. And now the story is vast; it's changing all the time. But one thing is, it's a fact: the Gracie family was the family that made all this podcast and the industry the way it is. That's a fact; nobody can never contest that. Okay, the Gracie family, me being friends and dealing and since I was a kid, being close friends and learn from them and still talk to, I talk to a Gracie family member every single day in WhatsApp. Like I was just talking to my master college Gracie Jr. like a minute ago through WhatsApp. Yeah. So I know that the way that they act, they live, they conduct their business is very family oriented. It's very kind of like, let's get together and conquer the world. It's kind of like, let's eat this way because it's better. Everybody follows. It's like, man, when you go there, refuse to quit, never quit, let's go, you know, like that kind of thing. Man, like the Gracie family put a culture in place. We all derive from their culture. Yeah. You know, it's a huge family. And a lot of times, like people don't agree with certain things they say they do. But the reality is that they were pivotal to the cultural movement, I'm not even going to say movement or lifestyle, to the cultural movement that we're seeing right now all over the world. Okay? Look at what the IBJJF did. They're all over the world. Look what, like, the first, like, Valetudo MMA fights, there were, like, a more broadcasted, like, never forgetting what they did in Brazil, but what's going on in Brazil, nobody knew. But when Royce did what he did in the UFC, then Hickson did in Japan, and then Hanzo did also in America in Japan, and Master Carlos Gracie Jr., what he did with the Federation Men. Somehow it's all connected to the Gracies. What Jorge and Gracie did, launching the UFC too, a lot of people forgot. He invented the whole thing.
Yeah.
Even though he's not one of the owners anymore. You know what I mean? So I think there's a lot to do also with the way the Gracies are. The Graces are very passionate people. When they're with them, they're your family. They put sleep in them on your house. They give you food. They give the shirt out of your back. But if you're their enemy, it's bad news. You know what I mean? So I think we're all like that in a certain sense. We get our cultures, we got our family raisings and all that, but we all take a little bit of that. Everybody that does jiu-jitsu nowadays take a little bit of that.
And
I think that's actually the icing on the cake of everything we're talking about today.
And you know, with people, I think, like you said, you mentioned something earlier of like people, they see 5 minutes and not further.
Yeah.
And I feel like that what you're talking about with the Gracie family and what they built and created in that culture, that brings up an interesting point of people forget how valuable their competition is.
Yeah.
You know, the hero needs the villain. Like, you know, that you need the competitive edge because it drives you to succeed more. And I think that sometimes like that's what gets lost is people, they forget to be appreciative of the other guy in the ring or of the other team or of the other school or the other association, the other federation.
Exactly.
And, you know, and when you look at fighters, like they get that, you know, fighters get that in that moment of like, man, I'm glad you trained. I'm glad you showed up. You know, you gave me your best so I could test myself. But then when it starts getting organizational wide and you start getting kind of that groupthink, I feel like people start losing the appreciation for the other guys because that's what drives them to be better. I mean, I know when I became a fighter as a teenager, my motivations were not ideas of grandeur of changing the world through inspiration. It was like, I'm going to show everybody how tough I am. Like, you know, 17 years old.
Yeah, brother, this is all part of evolution. You are an example of what happened to pretty much almost everybody. It's evolution. But if you don't evolve, that's something wrong.
Yeah.
That's my point here. We're talking about organizations really quick. Like, man, there are great organizations in every sport, and jiu-jitsu is no different, okay? But, man, when I see people bashing on the IBJJF, it's not perfect. Don't get me wrong. No organization is perfect. But they go, oh, they're just about the money. They're a faceless organization. Brother, for years and years, I saw, nobody told me, I was there. I saw the CBJJ in Brazil that was like the mother of IBJJF.
Yep.
The CBJJ was inside Master Carlos Gracie Jr.'s living room on a two-bedroom house. That family, Master Carlos Gracie Jr. family, for easily 7 years, had no privacy whatsoever. It was him, his wife, his kids, cousins, because the Gracies always bring people to live with them, you know, one of those things. And man, like Marcelo Siriema, the head guy of the IBJJF right now, working 9 to 5 at least in his living room, in Master Carlos' living room. There was always people there. There was an internet. People had to bring the registration of the tournaments in papers. And with the money, they had to count. They had to write down everything on paper. There was no internet. There was no brackets online. Nothing. Zero. Everybody had to go to the bank and come back. And then weigh-ins in his house. People got in fights. I saw it. Fist fight. Inside his living room.
Yeah.
And then people forget about that. Oh, it's a faceless organization. People don't see what they did back there, man. To get in this.
Yeah. It's that typical overnight success that was like 20 years in the making.
Exactly. People never remember that. Like even for us, they see where you at. They don't see the struggles before. So they'll say that they are a faceless organization. No, man. They did what you would never do. You would never put people on your living room like all day with your family there, with your kid, with your daughter there. You know, and these guys did it because nobody told me. Like I said, I saw it with my own eyes. I lived it. And now people are going to come and throw rocks. Yeah, it's not perfect, man. So it's not all the other organizations. And look, if you hate them, fine. Do better.
I love that. I say that all the time.
Yeah. Do better. Oh, don't hate them. Do better. Do better. And if you do better, the market will follow you. But if the market is following, if the market is following them, if they're making millions, that's a point. It's not because they never bashed on any other organization. Did you see like the IBJJF talking crap about other organizations? They never did that. Master Carlos actually told me that one time. Said, look, when people are talking all kinds of crap about Gracie Barra and about IBJJF, he always stays quiet. He stays quiet. He said, look, the market is open. If they want to do better than mine, let them do it. But I'm not going to reply back. I'm not going to talk back. The market is open. They're all welcome to try to do better than us. And I'm going to keep doing my thing. You know, that's the thing. You know what I mean? So I learned that from him a lot. The vision from Master Carlos, my master, Master Carlos Gracie Jr. He's very quiet, reserved. He doesn't do interviews, as everybody knows. He's like a very kind of low profile guy. He doesn't like to be in the limelight. When he's like in public events, he got kind of in a way like watching the matches and quiet. And if people come, he treats well, but he's not like, he doesn't want to be like, no, he was never like that. But man, like his vision is amazing that he saw everything that is happening right now before, back in the day.
Yeah. And that's the thing that like, you know, when you do something successful, if you don't have the attacks and the criticism, then you have not made an impact. I mean, it's kind of like even when you look at martial arts schools, like bigger martial arts schools with a big team, they usually aren't worried about like the little garage that has three people in it. You know, like it's not on their radar. So, and that's the whole thing is like when you make a large enough impact, the negativity comes with it. And I think as an athlete, it's the same way.
Yeah.
Where there was probably a time in your life where when people were critical of you or said something, you probably were very confrontational. It was like, let's go find him. Where is he at? I'm going to go face to face. But then in a certain transition, it probably no longer affected you because you started seeing it's more about them than it is about you. Exactly. Do you feel like that's something that you went through as an athlete?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you, man. Like part of evolution. Okay. I'm just going to say the truth here. I'm not going to lie or say anything. I am naturally aggressive. I'm actually too intense sometimes, and I pay for it. I still do. Of course, not as bad as he was before. But I used to be very confrontational on something that sometimes somebody said something that I wasn't even that bad. I was like, hey, what? And I found out that if I lived like that all the time, I'll be the unhappiest person in the world. Because, man, number one, you have to admit that, number one, you will screw up sometimes and you do something that is not good at all.
Yeah.
Sometimes you will have people that will not like you because the energy doesn't click or because of whatever reason, sometimes you did something that they didn't like. And you're going to have people that will hate you and criticize you just because they cannot see success.
Right.
So all these situations will happen and it's totally out of your control. What you can't control is how you react to them. And what you can't control is how you use wisdom to not do the same mistakes as before. That's evolution, right?
Yeah.
So that's what I try to do all the time. I am still a very, I wouldn't say stubborn. The word is, how can I say? Sometimes I react too fast without thinking too much about certain things. Sometimes I'm
reactionary.
Reactionary, exactly. I'm really reactionary. Boom, boom, right there. You know? And I'm learning more and more to sometimes count to 10, analyze the situation, think through. I'm still working on it. I have to work on this like a lot still.
It's like jujitsu. It never stops.
It never stops. But I'm naturally like that. And I'm saying from my own experience that I have to catch myself sometimes like reminding myself of like, man, dude, look, this guy said that. Like now social media people say all kinds of things, you know. Man, most of the times there are guys that hate you because you have some sort of success. The problem is them, it's not you, right? Or sometimes you have to be humble enough to accept that you are the one that screwed up. Right? And a lot of people don't do that.
Yeah, people don't take responsibility a lot. Like that's, I mean, and that kind of goes back to there's a lot of people out there, especially within our industry, that I think are exactly in line with what you're saying of, you know, just pent up frustrations, anger, you know, you don't have a good discernment to control how you react to things. The distance between stimulus and response for some people is very close.
Oh yeah.
And then it puts them in a bad situation. So, you know, you being able to identify that about yourself and trying to grow through that, I mean, that's really the most admirable walk, because the guy that never had to battle that, that's one thing. Cause it was like, oh yeah, I never had that problem. Like that was easy.
Yeah,
the person that's had to deal with that and had circumstances happen and be responsible for your actions that now identifies that and is working on improving that. I mean, that's the admirable, wise person that you want to look to for leadership. So if you were going to try to help encourage somebody, you know, a younger athlete or just people that are, they're struggling with these anger, emotional problems of just outbursts, you know, what would you advise them to do to kind of get started of understanding how to mitigate that?
Man, like I during my time as a coach and professor, which is like decades now, pretty much, I had to deal with the situation a bunch of times. I'm firm. Sometimes if I need to yell and be firm, I will be. Sometimes if I need to be more understandable. But I have to do this almost every single time, because being more experienced and people having trust on you that you were there, they listen to you, like it or not. When I say to them, I look at their eyes, and I sincerely, sorry about that, brother, my phone is ringing. But I tell them, say, look, listen to me. Don't go this way. I can easily tell you that. Don't go this way, because I've been there, or I know a lot of people that have been there, and that they take that will take you to this and that. You do whatever you want, but I'm giving you my sincere advice. You know, so a lot of people, like younger guys and even older guys, I have to do this all every single time. I'm still do. I'm not perfect, and sometimes I need advice like all of us. But man, like when I see something that is going through like a really bad route, and that and those are people that I care, it's my moral duty to help or to try to help, you know? And even if it's an awkward conversation, even if it's like an awkward moment, even if it's going to be like some tension, I have to do that. And honestly, I have no problem to do that. Okay. Because that was done to me a bunch of times, and I really appreciate every mentor, every person, my father, my mother, like my teachers, my instructors, like you know, my wife, everybody that told me something that I needed to listen on that time, even though I didn't like it, it was good for me. Thank you. Thank you very much, because he helped me.
Absolutely. And that's what the whole, you know, jiu-jitsu culture, like you said, it's a tribe and it's about helping each other. And so like along the way, you had all these mentors, you had all these coaches, you guys are competing and fighting all the time. When you go back to your competitive career, was there a match that you remember as being like one of your favorite matches that, win or lose, you loved it because of whatever happened, you know, the struggle, the competition? Was there any match that you remember that just you loved?
Man, like honestly, I really loved a lot of my matches, and for different reasons. I think like one, I would say two matches. There was one match that I did as a black belt, I would say it's better. There was one match that I did on the Pan Ams on 98 that I went against two of the best Hoyler guys by the time. One was Fredson Alves, and the other one was Vini Aieta. Vini Aieta is the main instructor for Hoyler in Brazil still. And he's the teacher of Vinicius Magalhães, the Pezão guy that won the fight at UFC. He's the for Fabricio Morango, the fighting UFC, Leticia Ribeiro, and even Saulo for a little bit, like one of his coaches. Anyway, he's a great guy. This tournament, like, I faced this tough competition, and everything went exactly according to what I did. I wasn't super well trained, but my head was in the right place. I had just had a super fight against a really tough guy, and I won. And I went there with the perfect mindset, and I did great. I beat Fredson, and then I submitted Vini at the finals. You know, like one of those things that everything works perfectly. So I remember that, and I really appreciate of that. But the other one was actually against Hoyler. I had three matches against Hoyler. The last one was the 99 and the semifinals. It was a boring, bad match that not me or him did anything. It was horrible. I wasn't happy, and I'm pretty sure he wasn't happy too. But we're so competitive that we kind of nullified each other and nothing happened. And then there was one a year before in 98 was actually the final. And for this tournament, I was more prepared than any other fighter tournament that I did in my life. I trained so much. I was so focused. And it was so many tough people on my bracket. Man, my bracket on that year had names like Megaton, Marco Barbosa, João Roque, Marco Aurelio, a guy that actually beat Hoyle a couple of years before. Marco Aurelio from he's American Top Team. He was from Carson. Man, we have Wagner Fabiano from Nova União that is like wins local everything. He's like Leo Santos' older brother. We had like, man, like Soneca. We have like, man, like it was a very tough bracket. Let's put it this way. And Paulo Coelho, Fredson, all the men, like if I keep remembering, it's like everybody was tough. It was like Thiago Asfora, shit, like too many. Yeah. And actually, it was five matches. I did five matches on the black belt division on the same day this day. And I couldn't submit anybody. So it was 10-minute matches, 5 10-minute matches. The first four was back-to-back. And then the last one with Hoyler, because the TV was a sport TV in Brazil, so we had to wait. And then it got to go in certain times, so we waited kind of like a couple hours. But anyway, this match was good before because I got smashed by Holler two years before in the finals of the World Series. I got smashed. It was like 9-0. I got crushed, even though it was just – he did 9-0 in 2 minutes. Let's put it this way, because I was dead. And then it was 0-0, and then he killed me. Anyway, and then I was like, no, man, this isn't exacto. I would train my ass off. And I don't know if I'm going to beat him, but it's going to be war.
Yeah,
and man, there was so many great people in the bracket. There was kind of like a little disrespectful, but I knew in my mind, and I say to everybody, I said, man, I don't care. It's going to be me and him on the finals. And I knew it would be me and him in different brackets because, I mean, they used to put like the favorites kind of like separated to make it more exciting. They did this all the time in the IBJJF. So I said, I know for a fact, 100%, that nobody who they put in front of me today, I will lose. I'll beat everybody. It was tough, close matches, but I beat everybody. And I knew I would be on the finals with Hoyler. I knew for a fact. And it happened. But that was the lesson. I focused so much on being on the final and not beating him, right? That even though it was a really close match, it was a war, it was another lesson for me. I shouldn't have even just putting all my energy and saying like me and Hoyle on the final again and I'm going to give him hell. It should be anybody, including Hoyle, we get in front of me and I'll beat. It was a close match. It was a war. But I still came out short. I lost by like some people say still won. Like it's still I don't mind. Honestly, bro, look, I don't lose sleep because of that because I did my best.
Right.
You know? And that was a match that also marked me. At the finals, I guess, Hoyler World Championships, 1998. Yeah, probably those two that come into mind.
What do you feel like that taught you about goal setting? You know, because you're talking about, like, you're focused on just getting to the finals, things of that nature. So what did you learn from that experience as far as how to specifically set goals? What did you take from that?
As I said before, the goal, for example, from this time as a competitor, my goal should be gold medal. And my goal wasn't that in the back of my mind. Of course, I wanted, I tried, and I left everything in there. I wanted the gold medal, but it wasn't like the title. It was more kind of like me and Hoyler again, let's go.
Yeah.
Whoever they put in front of me, I'll overcome and be there. Whoever they put in front of him, I knew he would come also because he was on his prime. He was the man. So that was my thing. And then I was kind of like, man, I focus. I put all my energy so much on the moment, on the final itself, but not on the gold medal. If it was somebody else other than Hoyler, who knows, I'll probably get crushed because you threw me off, you know?
Yeah.
So there was another lesson. It was another lesson of, man, at the end of the day, it was great because we are in one of the toughest brackets ever in the history of the featherweight, even for today's standards, if you compare. But it's not about who you go against with. It's about the title. Because at the end of the day, man, people don't remember who you went against. They're going to remember the title, you know.
So what's something that you accomplished in your life that you feel you accomplished it because of what you learned about goal setting from that situation, you know, that was very specific? Like, is there anything that's just happened or come into your life that was so specific that you know exactly why it came up because you focused on it so much that maybe other people didn't notice or they thought, oh, good for you? Was there something that ever happened like that?
What the biggest lesson I learned is that correct hard work beats anything. Correct, honestly, truthful, hard work is what counts in everything in life. Every single little thing. I'm not saying stupid hard work to break stones with your head, for example. Oh, it's hard work, but man, it's stupid. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Finding the correct way to put, like I said, honest first, because anything that is kind of towards cheating doesn't survive long enough. Honest hard work, truthful hard work. These things, man, they are the most important things in anything in life. You have to work hard for every single little thing, you know. And I learned that. Everything that I didn't work hard enough, they're not good in my life enough. When I put the focus in something 100% in the way I said, I'll get rewarded for that. It will be the natural reward in every single little thing, every single little thing, like trivial things to big picture things. So I learned that in my life that if you want to summarize the hard work, it sounds biased, but it's really the truth. You know,
well, I mean, that's really some profound input as far as, you know, honest hard work and focusing. And I really feel like people are going to resonate with the way that you illustrated, you know, just what it took to be successful and just being kind of aware of your own weaknesses. And I, you know, a lot of times people are afraid of their own weaknesses, but when you identify your weaknesses, you're going to be a better performer. I mean, different in jiu-jitsu. Like, I mean, if I'm better on top than on bottom, then obviously you want to keep the game where you get to stay on top of your best. You can handle the bottom. You can cope with those struggles, but you want to keep yourself in the most dominant position. I think people are going to really take that to heart. And I really appreciate you taking time to talk to me today. Is there anything you'd like to finish with?
No, Caleb, it was a great talk, man. It was like a talk a little different than normally I do because people ask more like historical questions or technical questions. It was kind of more like towards a... It's kind of very similar to what I did with Gustavo Dantas like a while ago. Yeah. It was pretty cool, you know? So I really appreciate your time. Thank you very much for the excellent questions. You're a very intelligent guy, as far as I can see, successful guy too. All my best to you and to all jiu-jitsu community. And let's hope we're going to get through this and get back stronger than ever.
Yes, sir. For sure. Thank you for taking the time today. I hope you have a great day.
Thank you, brother. You too. See you guys later.